We have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish, co-editor with Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
No Maria this morning. She is ill.
Yes, she is. I was going to say under the weather, but what does that really mean? We're all under the weather.
Pretty much.
Because if we were over the weather, we'd be like in an airplane or something.
Yeah, or on a very, very high peak. All right. We'll get into that later. Let's start out with local and multiple things happening down in our state's capital, Olympia.
Yeah, of course, many, many bills, usually upwards of 2,000, are introduced every every legislative session, but not that many that have a good chance of passage, and several notable ones have been introduced in the last week that I wanted to talk about. One from Representative Eileen Cody of Seattle was a bill to close $150 million or so in tax loopholes to try and save the basic health plan. Now, this is a bill that, because it raises revenue, will have a difficult time passing because it requires a two-thirds majority, thanks to the Tim Iman initiative that passed last fall. But it does spotlight both the desirability of trying to save the basic health care plan and also highlights some of the tax loopholes that really do need attention from the state legislature. That includes a $50 million loophole for banks for mortgage loans, a loophole for the Centralia coal plant, breaks for corporate jets, and breaks for cosmetic surgery. Again, because the Senate rulemaker, which is the Senate president, namely the Lieutenant Governor Brad Owens, a very conservative Democrat, is inclined to interpret any extra revenue that results from a piece of legislation as being a tax increase and thus falling under the Iman initiative. It will probably require a two-thirds vote in order to pass, and then it's questionable whether Gregoire would sign it, since she's been somewhat of a champion of these corporate tax loopholes. But it's good this debate is happening, and again, anything that puts more attention on the fact that we are choosing as a state legislature and as a state to gut state services and gut education and care for the elderly and disabled and the social safety net and so forth, in order to preserve money for Microsoft and Boeing and their various allies. That fact needs to be highlighted over and over again. And some of these things like corporate jets and the cosmetic surgery and the underwriting of the Centralia coal plant is just ridiculous.
Wow.
The Centralia coal plant itself was the focus of another bill, this one from Representative Mark Elias of Edmonds. He's introduced a bill that would make the Centralia coal plant phase out coal by 2015. The coal plant in Centralia is the only one in the state that uses coal. It's a huge greenhouse gas emitter and has been really the focus for the last several years of a number of environmental groups around the state. Christine Gregoire has been negotiating with TransAlta, the owner of the coal plant, for years, but as of the latest, is looking only at 2025 for a coal-free date. So this would move up that timeline quite dramatically from 14 years to 4 years. And that bill, again, from Representative Mark Elias. We've talked in past weeks about a medical marijuana dispensary bill that's winding its way through the Senate. There's a substitute bill that was introduced this past week that's going to be voted on Monday. This bill would continue to set up legitimize a network of licensed dispensaries and also regulate the production of marijuana, but it has a couple of several changes. The most notable of them are that the employment protection is out. That is to say, if your workplace has a drug screening program that makes you pee in a cup and would sanction you if you test positive for marijuana use, you would not have protection against sanction by that employer if you're a licensed medical marijuana patient. That was taken out by the revised version of this bill. Also, sales tax would now apply to sales of medical marijuana, but according to one of the organizers of the bill, nothing that we can't live with, and it looks fairly likely at this point that this might actually pass, but it's important to try and get as many votes for that as possible for the vote on Monday, because they're hoping to make sure that Gregoire would sign it. So if you have a chance, call your state senator this weekend and ask them to vote yes on Monday on the state medical marijuana dispensary bill.
All right. And that's not to be confused with the other marijuana.
No, there's also a bill from Mary Lou Dickerson that would that would totally decriminalize marijuana for recreational use. That has a much, much slimmer chance of passage. That's not to be confused with the dispensary bill.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm still thinking about the two-thirds vote required to reinstitute taxes that already existed that isn't required for cutting the social safety net.
Yeah, kind of amazing, isn't it?
All right, let's move a little closer to home, and Mayor McGinn weighing in on the tunnel.
Yeah, McGinn announced this week that he will veto the three city council agreements with the state for tunnel construction. Those agreements commit the city to paying for any cost overruns on the tunnel, which has long been a sticking point for McGinn. And you've got people on both sides of the equation saying different things. The city officials and the city council insisting that, no, the city isn't actually on the hook for those, possible and probable at this point cost overruns. And, people in the various state legislators who would have the final say on it saying, yes, their intent actually is to stick the city within city taxpayers with the bill. McGinn has said he would veto them. However, the 8-1 passage, only Mike O'Brien among city council members voted no. O'Brien, of course, a very close McGinn ally. Everybody else voted yes, and that's enough to override a veto if McGinn does veto it and if none of those votes change. So chances are that those tunnel agreements are, in fact, going to become a law despite the McGinn veto.
I understand Richard Conlon was fairly vocal about McGinn's proposed move here.
I don't know
if you caught any of that.
Yeah, Conlon has been one of the biggest cheerleaders for the tunnel and the tunnel agreements among council members, and he's been very critical of McGinn. And there's also rumors he's one of several city council members, Tim Burgess and Tom Rasmussen being the other most prominent, that may be trying to position themselves for a mayoral run against McGinn in 2013. So we're starting to see those delineations come up around the tunnel issue.
All right. Also this week, developments regarding a upcoming levy.
Yeah, McGinn announced this week families and education levy ballot measure, which runs every 7 years. It was initially introduced by Norm Rice in 1996 and was renewed in 2004 for 7 years. They will have it on the ballot again in 2011, a 7-year, $231 million ballot measure that would nearly double the amount a typical Seattle homeowner pays for early learning and youth services. It would become an average of $124 a year that the average household pays rather than the $65 a year under the last levy adopted in 2004. That money, in case you're wondering what in heck a family and education levy buys you, it would go for supportive services for kids in Seattle public schools, including health screening, summer school, support for immigrant and refugee families, case management, sports, school learning health centers, and college and career planning. So, in case you're wondering about this, it would nearly double the amount of money that's being spent on this while the state is slashing K-12 spending. Now, so a lot of that K-12 spending goes into direct classroom services and things like teacher salaries as opposed to some of these ancillary services. But, the money is on the one hand a reflection of the fact that the state is cutting its funding for schools, and school districts, including Seattle's school district, are having to tighten their budgets accordingly and cut out some of these non-classroom activities without some of the additional support from this levy. But at the same time, you're getting a phenomenon where the city is putting money not back into the classroom, which is also absorbing a lot of cuts, but putting money back into some of these ancillary activities like, the irony that we can play more football and offer counseling services for the handful of people who can still afford state colleges, but we can't actually put more money to retain some of the teachers that are being laid off. It's very other worrisome. The other part of this levy that's worrisome, and there's a real danger in a bad economy of running into taxpayer fatigue on this. Not only are they looking at nearly doubling the amount of money people would pay under this levy, but they're going to be, in all probability, two other levies that are going to be on the Seattle ballot in 2011. One of them for for reconstruction of the seawall, and one of them for light rail expansion. Now, all of these things taken, you know, by themselves are all worthy goals, and that's the calculation. It's kind of an old budget game to put more controversial things in a general budget and then seek separate funding from the voters for things that they think, oh, the voters would never turn this down. And actually, there's a very long history of Seattle taxpayers saying yes to these kind of levies. But in a very bad economy like this, and with people stressed financially, it really increases the chances that people are going to say no, and that a lot of really worthy things that ought to be funded are not going to be funded as a result.
Yeah, I know in this area, the education levy almost passes like every time.
Yeah.
But doubling it, that'll be interesting.
Yeah. Now, this is not the education levy per se. That goes directly to the school district. This goes to a city fund that helps out the Seattle schools, but is not administered directly by the school district.
All right. And finally, someone potentially throwing their hat into the race for attorney general?
Yes, state attorney general's race may well that seat now occupied by Rob McKenna, who's widely expected to run for governor in 2012. So that raises the question of who would become the new state attorney general. And one of the most likely candidates did in fact throw his hat in the ring this week. King County Council member Bob Ferguson, a Democrat, announced that he was going to run for state attorney general. Now, Ferguson has been on the county council, I believe, for nearly a decade at this point. He originally ran as kind of an outsider who doorbelled pretty relentlessly to beat a couple of Democratic incumbents, first Cynthia Sullivan and then Carolyn, I want to say Carolyn Stevens, but I know that's not right, but... anyway, he's a formidable campaigner, but at the same time, he's probably going to be running against Reagan Dunn, who is a King County Council member, who is a Republican, who's also looking at the state attorney general seat. And of course, they're blazing the path that was set by McKenna, who was originally on the King County Council before he ran for state attorney general two terms ago. So that looks like that's how that race is shaping up, and we're probably going to get McKenna himself running for governor in 2012.
Yeah, I can remember Bob Ferguson literally came to my door twice. I don't know whether that shows that he's dogged or got early Alzheimer's. So,
or just really needed a job.
There you go. All right, moving on to national healthcare ruling in Florida.
Yeah, Florida federal judge Roger Vinson ruled the entire Obama healthcare reform package that was passed by Congress last year was unconstitutional. He ruled the mandate the lawsuit that was filed by a number of Republican state attorneys general, including McKenna. He ruled that the mandate that people buy health care coverage, that portion of it was unconstitutional. But as a result, he threw out the entire package, not just the health care mandate. Now, the lawsuit wasn't that much of a surprise that he ruled in this way. The lawsuit was specifically filed in a conservative Florida district to get the case before this particular conservative Republican appointed district court judge. The decision continues the trend of a Democratic appointees ruling the law constitutional. Two of those have happened so far, and two Republican appointees have ruled the law unconstitutional. What that means is that we are likely to see the question of the constitutionality of the entire health care reform package and how much of it can be implemented or whether it'll all get thrown out. That's likely to go all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, where, of course, we have four Republican ideologues among the nine members in Alito and Roberts and Scalia and Thomas. That means that you would have to have all five other Supreme Court justices rule in favor of the health care package in order for it to be retained. So very worrisome future for the state, for the federal health care reform package, particularly since they're the Republicans who have much more veto power over any replacement package that could possibly be passed, really haven't spelled out what they wanted in terms of any kind of healthcare reform. They seem to be perfectly happy with the status quo of insurance companies and a big pharma becoming extremely wealthy, while the rest of us get very poor, very sick, or both.
And any sense for when that would go before the Supreme Court?
It would take at least another year to go through district courts at this point, through the circuit courts, and then from there it would go to the Supreme Court. So it's a two-step process still, and that would take at least a year.
All right. Moving on to ruling this week in California.
Yeah, a ruling from Judge Ernest Goldsmith of San Francisco Superior Court that California regulators erred in greenhouse made a mistake in greenhouse gas emissions regulations in not considering alternatives to the cap and trade system that California is attempting to put in place. Now, a carbon tax would be one of those possible alternatives. What they were looking at specifically, this was a lawsuit that was filed by poorer communities, which are concerned that industrial polluters who are among the leading spewers of greenhouse gas emissions also emit other pollutants, and they're concerned that they would simply buy off those pollutants and set a bad precedent for concentrating pollution in poorer communities and non-white communities in California. So it's not clear at this point whether that's a minor fix or whether that could derail the entire process of trying to regulate greenhouse gases in California, potentially a very major court ruling down there.
All right. Moving on, it came up this week that there's a Republican bill to redefining rape.
Yeah, well, it's actually a portion of a bill, and they've backed off on it after the outcry. But this was a bill that was brought forward by Republicans in order to further try and restrict access to abortion services by pregnant women. And one of the things that they would have done under it, there were a number of different provisions to make it much more difficult, particularly for Medicaid recipients, namely poor women, to receive abortions. It would have redefined rape to mean only forcible rape, so that if you were a victim of incest or I don't know what exactly they meant by forcible rape, because forcible wasn't actually really very clearly defined in the bill. They didn't really specify what they meant by it, but it would clearly have exempted statutory rape. It clearly would have exempted incest. Maybe it would have exempted everybody who didn't have a gun held to their head. And of course, since we live in a nation that's protected by the Second Amendment, people who wave guns around can't be rapists. They're heroes, by goodness. So it was a really alarming bill, because it shows the direction of the debate at this point is all about unborn fetuses and not at all about the rights of women. That bill probably does not have a good chance of passage. And even if it does have a chance of passage, President Obama is likely not to sign it. But we're seeing more and more of these types of bills over the course of recent years. And as with so many other brands of Republican crazy lately, the real danger is in the mainstreaming of once unthinkable ideas. You know, the idea that even anti-abortion activists in past years were willing to make exceptions for case of rape and incest, that's going away. It's becoming much more common that the Republicans are becoming absolutists on that issue. And that's been the direction of the debate in the last few years. Very, very worrisome.
All right. Moving on to international, starting with Egypt.
Yeah, let's actually not start with Egypt,
right?
Because people are very familiar with what's going on there, although we want to spend some time on it because it really is a legitimately huge story. But I want to spend some time on other countries in the Middle East that have been seeing major demonstrations these past couple of weeks, and really haven't been getting nearly as much attention especially from American media as Egypt has. Egypt has been the largest of these demonstrations and also the one that's most likely to topple its American supported dictator. But there have also been major demonstrations in Jordan, in Syria, in Yemen, and in Syria, although in the case of Syria, it's not so much a U.S. supported dictator, but still a dictator nonetheless. Yemen is probably the most serious of these. Ali Abdullah Saleh has been in power there since 1978, and there have been major demonstrations there, but it's fairly likely that Saleh is going to remain in power at this point. He has raised bread and food subsidies. He's allowed the nonviolent demonstrations and not loosed his thugs on them the way Mubarak has in Egypt. And he's also pledged not to run again in 2013 or allow his son to run. Now, all of these things are things that have happened at one or another point in Egypt, but there's an additional wrinkle with the situation in Yemen, which is that Saleh faces two separatist movements within the country, plus a large and very vigorous Al-Qaeda movement in Yemen. And so there's a lot of legitimacy to his claims to his fellow countrymen that, look, if I'm not in power here, there could be real chaos. It's not just a question of the Muslim Brotherhood, which in Egypt is actually a very mainstream political party, but there are separatist movements that would pose a very real danger to large constituencies in Yemen. So they're much more likely to go for the whole, you know, security over freedom kind of argument.
It's also where the U.S. has done drone strikes as well.
Yes, the U.S. has done drone strikes there, and of course the Yemen military is receiving a lot of aid from the United States and is also carrying out its own operations against these separatist movements as well as against Al-Qaeda.
So that doesn't make the populace particularly happy with the U.S. policy there.
No, that's very true, although that's kind of a common theme in all of these situations, that the people are not particularly happy with the United States. For some reason, that just seems to be a theme that repeats itself over and over again. We really need just a better communications policy. That's a good PR firm would fix it all. In Jordan, there have been large demonstrations there against the king, who has replaced his government. He's hired fired his cabinet, replaced his prime minister, etc. He's also put new subsidies into place. The complication there, and again the reason why he's not likely to be toppled, is that the opposition is very fractured. There's a real dynamic in Jordan where native Jordanians, rather, who dominate the civil service, are somewhat divided against Palestinian refugees and ethnic Palestinians who tend to dominate the private sector, so that you can have economic reforms. And once again, in Jordan, as with many of these countries, there's large unemployment, real economic problems, and a demand that the king deal with economic issues, that if he puts more money into the civil service, he's got one constituency and alienates the another. If he puts more money into trying to alleviate poverty through the private sector, again, he's showing favoritism to one side over the other. So in either case, he's got a natural constituency in a way that Mubarak in Egypt does not. And then finally, there's Syria, which is probably the least likely of these countries to have any kind of overthrow. And that's simply due to the nature of the repression there. The government has not allowed large-scale demonstrations, although there have been small ones. There was a call for a day of rage demonstration on Friday that didn't happen. So far on Saturday, also it hasn't been happening. Now, Syria also has a very large civil sector. In fact, one out of every six workers in Syria works for the Syrian government. Their dictator there announced a 17% pay increase for government workers this past week. So once again, these demonstrations are forcing all of these Middle Eastern despots to scramble, and by and large, the preferred course of action is to try and buy off the opposition, so that the ordinary people are getting something out of this. What they're not getting is any kind of freedom.
All right. So then that moves us on to developments in Egypt.
Egypt this week, there are large demonstrations again today in Cairo and other Egyptian cities, and we saw this week several notable developments, particularly the use of government thugs in order to try and attack the pro-democracy demonstrators in Tahrir Square and other areas of Cairo. That hasn't seemed to work. Again, yesterday and today been very large demonstrations, and those demonstrators have not been dissuaded, even though a number of people were killed and some 8,000 were injured during direct clashes between pro- and anti-Mubarak forces this week. In terms of American coverage, is focused most heavily on the U.S. relationship with Egypt and has been missing several pretty key pieces to this dynamic. One is that Obama, even though his statements and the statements of administration and other U.S. figures have been becoming slowly more strident over time, and particularly the use of government thugs this week elicited a lot of concern from politicians in Europe as well as in the United States. But the United States has still not directly called for Mubarak to step down right now, which is the demonstrators' demand. And there's a playbook, as Noam Chomsky says. There's a pretty established arc that these type of stories take. In the past, with long-term U.S.-supported dictators that are facing people's revolutions. And we saw it in the case of Suharto in Indonesia. We saw it with baby Doc Duvalier in Haiti. We saw it with Ferdinand Marcos in the Philippines, where the U.S. sticks with the dictator as long as it possibly can, and then if it seems inevitable that the guy is going to be deposed, we switch sides, and we start talking about democracy. Meanwhile, behind the scenes, we're trying to set things up so that some other pro-American force can take power and take advantage of the vacuum in leadership, whether that's in the guise of a democratically elected leader or whether it's in the guise of a new dictator. Whatever works, basically. The United States is looking for somebody who will play ball with it, and those kind of discussions are almost certainly going on right now behind closed doors, most notably the name of the new vice president that Mubarak appointed, Sulaiman, seems to be coming up as somebody the United States would like to see take at least an interim and maybe more than an interim role in Egyptian leadership in a post-Mubarak era. Mubarak, for his standpoint, seems to be taking a lesson from Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, who has really schooled other Middle Eastern leaders on how to get lots of aid from the United States while still thumbing your nose at the United States and what it wants you to do. Mubarak, in his case, is still happy to take billions of dollars in annual aid from the United States for his military, but is essentially ignoring American advice when it comes to things like the thugs that he's hired to beat up on journalists. And then finally, the other point that I wanted to make on all of this has been the spectacle of journalists being attacked along with ordinary demonstrators in Egypt, and the fact that elite American journalists, and particularly television celebrities like Anderson Cooper and some of the people from Fox News and CNN and the New York Times, that have been attacked by the pro-Mubarak thugs this week and are shocked, absolutely shocked, that anybody would single them out. Well, you know, if they taking a chance even to do a little bit of cursory reading up on Egypt while they sat in business class on their flights over to Cairo to parachute into the country, they might have become aware that this has been the fate of journalists in Egypt under the American money and the American-supported dictatorship for many, many years. There's a long history of Egyptian journalists and Egyptian bloggers who say anything remotely questioning of the regime there to be beaten, to be tortured, and sometimes worse. And that's been going on for all of 2 weeks with Egyptian and Arabic reporters, with Al Jazeera reporters and reporters from the other Arabic networks. And it really only expanded in the last few days to include Western reporters. So they should be aware that, you know, journalism, as it's understood in the rest of the world, is not necessarily stenography. And what that means is that it can pose a threat to people in authority. And sometimes people in authority take it that way. They don't automatically assume that you're their friend the way they do here.
Yeah, I didn't catch the corporate media at the end of the week, but I know the early part of the week they're all doing, you know, their theme shows from out live from Egypt and calling the Mubarak thugs supporters. It'll be interesting to see if analyzing the news at the end of the week if they put in different word there after.
Well, no, they're still using supporters, and they're still not widely reporting that a lot of the people who were demonstrating in favor of America were found either to have IDs from the security services, because Egyptian state IDs also identify your profession, and or said that they had been paid in order to come and demonstrate on behalf of Mubarak. They weren't reporting that. They were consistently by a factor of about 10 lowballing compared to Al Jazeera and the other Arabic networks the estimates of the crowd sizes. And I really have to say that for daily reporting, Democracy Now! Has been doing an excellent job on weekdays.
In fact, they're actually doing a special weekend edition at 11 a.m. today.
Yeah, and then for 24/7 reporting, Al Jazeera English, which is available online, even though it's not on most U.S. cable systems, has also been very, very good. So I would encourage people to check that out as well.
All right. Events.
Yeah. Speaking of Egypt, there was a very well attended demonstration last week in Westlake Plaza, and folks are going to do it again and hopefully have an even larger and more vigorous demonstration in support of pro-democracy demonstrators in Egypt here, as well as this is a day of solidarity around the world. Literally hundreds of cities around the world are holding these demonstrations, and the one in Seattle will be from 12 to 2 o'clock today at Westlake Park, 4th and Pine, downtown Seattle. And then for folks who are listening at 7:30, you heard Dr. Margaret Flowers from Physicians for a National Health Plan. She will be speaking tonight, along with a couple of other speakers, at Kane Hall on the UW campus at 7 o'clock.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
You find it on your friendly local internet. Or inner tubes, or whatever, whatever the young people are calling them this week.
A series of tubes.
Yes, at www.eatthestate.org with news and opinion and comics and blogs and all kinds of good stuff. So check it out. www.eatthestate.org.